Chapter 2. I look around at the living, still and bound, hands and knees to stone, by what we found. Was a night as wearying as any just past? Was a dawn any crueller to find us this aghast? By your hand you are staying, and this is fair, but your words of blood are too bitter to bear. Song of Sorrows Unwitnessed, Napan Blight. From here onwards he could not trust the sky. The alternative, he observed as he examined the desiccated, rotted state of his limbs, invited despondency. Tulash Shaun looked round, noting with faint dismay the truncated lines of sight, an affliction cursing all who must walk the land's battered surface. Scars he had looked down upon from a great height only a short time earlier now posed daunting obstacles, a host of furrowed trenches carving deep, jagged gouges across his intended path.
She is wounded but does not bleed. Not yet, at any rate. No, I see now. This flesh is dead. Yet I am drawn to this place. Why?
He walked, haltingly, up to the edge of the closest crevasse, peered down. Darkness, a breath cool and slightly sour with decay, and something else. Tulash Shaun paused for a moment, and then stepped out into space and plunged downward. Threadbare clothing tore loose, whipped wild as his body struck rough walls, skidded and rebounded in a knock of withered limbs, tumbling amidst hissing grit and sand, the feathery brush and then snag of grass roots, and now stones spilling to follow him down. Bones snapped when he struck the boulder-studded floor of the fissure. More sand poured down on all sides with the sound of serpents. He did not move for a time. The dust, billowing in the gloom, slowly settled. Eventually he sat up. One leg had broken just above the knee. The lower part of the limb remained attached by little more than a few stretches of skin and sinew. He set the brake and waited while the two ragged ends slowly fused. The four ribs that now thrust broken tips out from the right side of his chest were not particularly debilitating, so he left them, conserving his power. A short while later he managed to stand, his shoulders scraping walls. He could make out the usual assortment of splintered bones littering the uneven floor, but these were only of mild interest, the fragments of bestial souls clinging to them, writhing like ghostly worms, disturbed by the new currents in the air. He began walking, following the odd scent he had detected from above. It was stronger down here, of course, and with each awkward step along the winding channel there arose within him a certain anticipation, bordering on excitement. Close now. The skull was set on a spear shaft of corroded bronze, rising to chest height and blocking the path. In a heap at the shaft's base was the rest of the skeleton, every bone systematically shattered. Tulash Shaun halted 2 paces from the skull.
Tarthano?
The voice rumbling through his head spoke, however, in the language of the Amas.
Bentracht, Scan all greets you, Revenant.
Your bones are too large for a Tlanimas.
Yes, but no salvation came of that.
Who did this to you, Skarnarl?
Her body lies a few paces behind me, Revenant.
If you so wounded her in your battle that she died, how was it that she could destroy your body with such vigor?
I did not say she was dead.
Tulash Shaun hesitated and then snorted.
No, nothing lives here. Either she is dead or she is gone.
I can hardly argue with you, Revenant. Now then, do this one thing. Look behind you.
Bemused, he did so. Sunlight fighting its way down through dust.
I see nothing.
That is your privilege.
I do not understand.
I saw her step past me. I heard her slide to the ground. I heard her cry out in pain and then weep. And when the weeping was done, all that remained was her breathing until that too slowed. But I can still hear it. The lift and fall of her chest with each rise of the moon. When its faint light reaches down, how many times? Many. I have lost count. Why does she remain? What does she want? She will not answer. She never answers.
Saying nothing, Tulash Shaun edged past the stake in its dusty skull. 5 strides further on, he halted, stared down.
Does she sleep, Revenant?
Tulas slowly crouched. He reached down and touched the delicate ribcage lying in a shallow depression at his feet. A newborn's fossilized bones, glued to the ground by calcified limestone.
Born to the tide of the moon, were you, little one? Did you draw even a single breath? I think not. Tlanimas, was this the end of your chase?
She was formidable.
A jackhut, a woman.
I was the last on her trail. I failed.
And is it that failure that torments you, Scarn All? Or that she now haunts you here behind you, forever hidden from your sight?
Awaken her! Or better still, slay her, Revenant. Destroy her! For all we know, she is the very last Jagat. Kill her and the war will be over, and I will know peace.
There is little peace in death, Tlanimas. Ah, child, the wind at night moans through you, does it? Night's very own breath to haunt him for all eternity.
Revenant, turn my skull. I would see her again.
Tulash Shaun straightened.
I will not step between you in this war.
But it is a war you can end.
I cannot. Nor, it is clear, can you. Scarn All, I must leave you now.
He looked down at the tiny bones.
Both of you.
Since my failure, Revenant, I have entertained not a single visitor. You are the first to find me. Are you of such cruelty as to condemn me to an eternity in this state? She defeated me. I accept this. But I beg of you, grant me the dignity of facing my slayer.
You pose a dilemma,
Tulash Shaun said after a moment's consideration.
What you imagine to be mercy may not prove any such thing, should I acquiesce. And then there is this. I'm not particularly inclined to mercy, Scarn All. Not with respect to you. Do you begin to comprehend my difficulty? I could indeed reach out and swing your skull round, and you may curse me for all time. Or I could elect to do nothing, to leave everything as I have found it, as if I was never here, and so earn your darkest resentment. In either case, you will see me as cruel. Now, this does not offend me overmuch. As I said, I am not stirred to kindness. The matter I face is, how cruel do I wish to be?
Think on that privilege I spoke of earlier, Revenant. Your simple gift of being able to turn yourself round to see what hides behind you. We both understand that what is seen may not be welcome.
Tulash Shaun grunted.
Tlanimas, I know all about looking over my shoulder.
He walked back to the skull.
Shall I be the brush of wind, then? A single turn, a new world to unfold?
Will she awaken?
I think not,
he replied, reaching out and settling one withered fingertip against the huge skull.
But you can try.
A slow increase in pressure, and with a grating squeal, the skull swung round. The T'lani Mas began howling in Tula Shorn's wake as he walked back up the channel.
Gifts are never what they seem. And the punishing hand? It too is not what it seems. Yes, these two thoughts are worthy of long echoes stretching into this wretched future. As if anyone will listen.
Vengeance, held tight like an iron-shod spear in her hand, and how it burned. Ralata could feel its searing heat, and the pain was now a gift, something she could feed upon, like a hunter crouched over a fresh kill. She'd lost her horse, she'd lost her people. Everything had been taken away from her, everything except this final gift. The broken moon was a blurred smear, almost lost in the green glow of the strangers in the sky. The skin-cut Bargast stood facing east, her back to the smouldering coals from the hearth, and looked out upon a plain that seemed to seethe in the jade and silver light. Behind her, the black-haired warrior named Draconis spoke in low tones with the Teblor giant. They talked often in some foreign tongue. Lethary, she supposed, not that she'd ever cared to learn it. Even the simpler trader's language made her head ache, but on occasion she caught some Lethary word that had made its way into the pigeon cant, so she knew they were speaking of the journey ahead. East. It was, for the moment, convenient for her to travel in their company, despite having to constantly fend off the Teblor's clumsy advances. Draconis was able to find game where none seemed to exist. He could call water up from cracked bedrock, more than just a warrior, a shaman. And in a scabbard of midnight wood strapped to his back, there was a sword of magic. She wanted it. She meant to have it. A weapon suited to the vengeance she desired. With such a sword, she could kill the winged slayer of her sisters. In her mind, she worked through scenarios. A knife across the man's throat when he slept, and then a stab through an eye for the Teblor. Simple, quick, and she would have what she wanted. If not for the emptiness of this land, if not for the thirst and starvation that would follow. No, for the time being, Draconis must live. For Ublala, however, if she could arrange a terrible accident, then she would not have him to worry about on the night she went for the sword. The dilemma of finding for the oath a fatal demise here on this featureless plain still defeated her, but she had time.
"Come back to the fire, beloved," the Teblor called, "and drink some tea. It has real leaves in it and stuff that smells nice."
Ralata massaged her temples for a moment, and then turned about.
"I am not your beloved. I belong to no one. I never will."
At seeing the half-smile on the face of Draconis as he tossed another dung chip onto the fire, Ralata scowled.
"It is rude,"
she pronounced as she walked over, squatted down and took the Kapu Blala proffered,
"to talk in a language I don't understand. You could be plotting my rape and murder for all I know."
The warrior's brows arched.
"Now, why would we want to do that, Bargast? Besides," he added, "Ublala is courting you."
"He might as well give up now. I don't want him."
Draconis shrugged.
"I have explained to him that most of what we call courting boils down to just being there. Every time you turn, you see him, until his company feels perfectly natural to you. Courting is the art of growing like mold on the one you want."
He paused, scratched at the stubble on his jaw.
"I can't lay claim to that observation, but I don't recall who said it first."
Ralata spat into the fire to announce her disgust.
"We're not all like Hetan, you know. She used to say she gauged the attractiveness of a man by imagining how he looked when she was staring up at his red face and bulging eyes."
She spat again.
"I am a skin cut, a slayer, a collector of scalps. When I look upon a man, I imagine what he'll look like with the skin of his face sliced away."
"She's not very nice, is she?"
Ublala asked Draconis.
Trying hard, you mean? Draconis replied. Makes me want to sex her even more than before. That's how these things work. It's torture. I don't like it. No, I do. No, I don't. I do. Oh, I'm going to polish my hammer.
Relata stared at Ublala as he surged to his feet and thumped off. Low and in the language of the white faces, Draconis murmured,
He means that literally, by the way.
She shot him a look and snorted.
I knew that. He has no wits for anything else.
She hesitated and then said,
His armor looks expensive.
It cost dearly, aye, Relata. He wears it well, better than one might have hoped.
He nodded, mostly to himself, she suspected, and said,
He will stand well, I think, when the time comes.
She remembered this warrior killing Sakara the Vile, snapping the old woman's neck. The ease of the gesture, the way he seemed to embrace her to keep her from falling, as if her lifeless body still clung to something like dignity. He was not a man easily understood.
What are you two seeking? You walk into the east. Why?
There are unfortunate things in the world, Relata.
She frowned.
I don't know what that means.
He sighed, studied the fire.
Have you ever stepped on something unintentionally? Out through a doorway, a sudden crunching underfoot? What was it, an insect, a snail, a lizard?
He lifted his head and fixed her with his dark eyes, the embers gleaming in lurid reflection.
Not worth a second thought, was it? Such are the vagaries of life. An ant dreaming of war, a wasp devouring a spider, a lizard stalking the wasp. All these dramas and crunch all over with. What to make of it? Nothing, I suppose. If you have a heart, you apportion out some small measure of guilt and remorse, and then continue on your way.
She shook her head, baffled.
You stepped on something?
In the manner of speaking.
He nudged the embers and watched as sparks spun upward.
No matter. A few ants survived. No end to the little bastards, in fact. I could crush 1,000 nests under heel and it did not make a whit of difference. That's the best way of thinking about it, in fact.
He met her eyes again.
Does that make me cold? What did I leave behind in those chains, I wonder, still shackled there, a host of forlorn virtues? Whatever. I am having odd dreams of late.
I dream only of vengeance.
The more you dream of one particular and pleasing thing, Relata, the quicker it palls. The edges get worn down, the luster fades. To leave such obsessions behind, dream of them often.
You speak like an old man, a Bargast shaman. Riddles and bad advice, Onos Tulan was right to discount them all.
She almost looked to the west, past his shoulder, as if she might find her people and the war leader all marching straight for them. Instead, she finished the last of the tea in her cup.
Onos Tulan. Draconis muttered. An Imas name. A strange war leader for the Bargast to have. Will you tell me the tale of that, Relata?
She grunted.
I have no skill for tales. Hetan took him for a husband. He was from the gathering when all the Tlanimas answered the summons of Silver Fox. She returned to him his life, ending his immortality, and then Hetan found him. After the end of the Panian War, Hetan's father was Humbral Tar, who had united the White-Face clans, but he drowned during the landing upon the shores of this continent.
A moment, please. Your tribes are not native to this continent?
She shrugged.
The Bargast gods were awakened to some peril. They filled the brains of the shamans with their panic like sour piss. We must return here to our original homeland to face an ancient enemy. So we were told, but not much else. We thought the enemy was the Tist Edur, then the Lethari, and then the Akrenai. But it wasn't any of them, and now we are destroyed. And if Sakara spoke truly, then Onos Tulan is dead, and so is Hetan. They're all dead. I hope the Bargast gods died with them.
Can you tell me more about these Tlanimas?
They knelt before a mortal man. In the midst of battle, they turned their backs on the enemy. I will say no more of them.
Yet you chose to follow Onos Tulan.
He was not among those. He stood alone before Silver Fox, a thing of bones, and demanded...
But Draconis had leaned forward, almost over the fire.
A thing of bones? Tlan? Telan! Abyss below!
He suddenly rose, startling Relata further, and she watched as he paced, and it seemed black ink was bleeding out from the scabbard at his back, a stain that hurt her eyes.
That bitch, he said in a low growl. You selfish, spiteful hag!
Ublala heard the outburst, and he suddenly loomed into the dull glow of the fire, his huge mace leaning over one shoulder.
What did she do, Draconis?
He glared at Relata.
Should I kill her? If she's being spellfish and sightful, what's rape mean anyway? It's got to do with sex? Can I...
Ublala, Draconis cut in. I was not speaking of Relata. The Teblor looked round.
I don't see no one else, Draconis. She's hiding? Whoever she is, I hate her. Unless she's pretty. Is she pretty? Mean is all right if they're pretty.
The warrior was staring at Ublala.
Best climb into your furs, Ublala, and get some sleep. I'll stand first watch. All right. I wasn't tired anyway.
He swung about and set off for his bedroll.
Be careful with those curses, Relata said in a hiss, rising to her feet. What if he strikes first and then asks questions?
He glanced across at her.
The Tlanimas were undead.
She nodded.
She never let them go?
Silver Fox? No. They asked, I think, but no.
He seemed to stagger, and turning away, he slowly sank down onto one knee, facing away from her. The pose was one of dismay or grief, she could not be sure. Confused, Relata took a step towards him and then stopped. He was saying something, but in a language she knew not. A phrase over and over again, his voice hoarse, thick.
Draconis?
His shoulders shook, and then she heard the rumble of laughter, a deathly humorless sound.
And I thought my penance was long.
Head still lowered, he said,
This Onos Tulan, is he now truly dead, Relata?
So Sakara said.
Then he is at peace, at long last, at peace.
I doubt it, she said.
He twisted round to regard her.
Why do you say that?
They killed his wife, they killed his children. If I was Onos Tulan, even death would not keep me from my revenge.
He drew a sharp breath, and it caught as if on a hook, and once more he turned away. The scabbard dripped blackness as if from an open wound.
Oh, how I want that sword.
Wants and needs could starve and die, no different from love. All the grand gestures of honor and faithful loyalty meant nothing when the only witnesses were grass, wind, and empty sky. It seemed to Mappo that his nobler virtues had withered on the vine, and the garden of his soul, once so verdant, now rattled skeletal branches against stone walls. Where was his promise? What of the vows he had uttered, so sober and grim in youth, so shiny of portent, as befitted the broad-shouldered brave he had once been? Mappo could feel dread inside, hard as a fist-sized tumor in his chest. His ribs ached with the pressure of it, but it was an ache he had lived with for so long now it had become a part of him, a scar far larger than the wound it covered.
And this is how words are made flesh. This is how our very bones become the rack of our own penance, and the muscles twitch in slick skins of sweat, the head hangs loose. I see you, Mappo, so slumped down in pathetic surrender. He was taken from you, like a bauble stolen from your purse. The theft stung, it stings still. You feel outraged, violated. This is pride and indignation, isn't it? These are the sigils on your banner of war, your lust for vengeance. Look upon yourself, Mappo. You mouth the arguments of tyrants now, and all shrink from your path. But I want him back at my side. I swore my life to protecting him, sheltering him. How can that be taken away from me? Can you not hear the empty howl in my heart? This is a pit without light, and upon all the close walls surrounding me I can feel nothing but the gouges my claws have made. The green sheen upon the broken land was sickly to his eyes, unnatural, an ominous imposition that made the shattering of the moon seem almost incidental. But worlds heal when we do not. Mustiness clung to the night air, as of distant corpses left to rot. There have been so many deaths in this wasteland. I don't understand it. Was this my Icarium's sword, his rage? I should have felt that, but the very ground barely breathes. Like an old woman in her death cot, she can but tremble to faraway sounds, thunder and a darkness upon the sky.
There is war,
Mappo grunted. They'd been silent for so long he'd almost forgotten Gruntle's presence, standing here at his side.
What do you know of it?
He asked, pulling his gaze away from the eastern horizon. The barb-tattooed caravan guard shrugged.
What is there to know?
Deaths beyond counting, slaughter to make my mouth water, hackles rise. Even in this gloom I can see the dismay in your face, Trell, and I share it. War, it is what it was and always will be. What else is there to say?
You yearn to join the fray?
My dreams tell me different.
Mappo glanced back at the camp. The humped forms of their sleeping companions, the more regular mound of the fresh burial cairn. The desiccated shape of cartographer seated upon the stones, a tattered wolf lying at his feet. Two horses, the scatter of packs and supplies, an air of death and sorrow.
If there is war, he said, facing Gruntle again, who profits?
The man rolled his shoulders, a habit of his, Mappo now knew, as if Trake's mortal sword sought to shift a burden no one else could see.
Ever the question, as if answers meant anything, which they don't. Soldiers are herded into the iron maw, and the ground turns to red mud, and someone on a nearby hill raises a fist in triumph, while another flees the field on a white horse.
I warrant Trake takes little pleasure in his chosen warrior's views on the matter. Warrant more how little I care, Mappo. A soul-taken tiger, but such beasts keep no company. Why should Trake expect anything different? We are solitary hunters. What manner of war can we hope to find? That is the irony in the whole mess. The tiger of summer is doomed to hunt the perfect war, but never find it. See how his tail lashes.
No, I see that. For the true visage of war, best turn to the snarling jaws of wolves.
Setok, he said in a murmur.
She has dreams of her own, I'm sure,
Gruntle said.
Traditional wars, Mappo mused, are fermented in the winter, when the walls close in and there is too much time on one's hands. The barons brood, the kings scheme, raiders plot their passages through borderlands. The wolves howl in winter, but come the season's turn, summer is born to the savagery of blades and spears, the savagery of the tiger. He shrugged. I see no conflict there. You and Setok, and the gods bound to you, you all complement one another.
It is more complicated than that, Trell. Cold iron belongs to the wolves. Trake is hot iron, a fatal flaw to my mind. Oh, we do well in the bloody press. But then you must ask, how in Hood's name did we get into such a mess in the first place? Because we don't think.
Gruntle's tone was both amused and bitter.
And so your dreams visit visions upon you, mortal sword? Troubling ones?
No one remembers the nice ones, do they? Yes, troubling. Old friends long dead stalk the jungle. They walk lost, arms groping. Their mouths work, but no sound reaches me. I see a panther, my mistress of the hunt, in these dreams, by the way. She lies gored and bloody, panting fast in shock, dumb misery in her eyes.
God?
Boar's tusk.
Fenner?
As the god of war, he was unchallenged, vicious as any tiger, and cunning as any pack of wolves. With Fenner in the ascendant, we knelt with heads bowed.
Your mistress lies dying?
Dying? Maybe. I see her, and rage fills my eyes in a flood of crimson. Gored, raped, and someone will pay for that. Someone will pay.
Mappo was silent.
Raped?
Gruntle then growled as befitted his patron god, and Mappo's nape hairs stiffened at the sound. The Trell said,
I will part this company on the morrow.
You seek the battlefield.
Which none of you need witness, I think. He was there, you see. I felt him, his power. I will find the trail, I hope. And you, Gruntle, where will you lead this troop?
East, a little south of your path, but I'm not content to walk at the side of the wolves for much longer. Setok speaks of a child in a city of ice.
Crystal.
Mappo briefly closed his eyes.
A crystal city.
And Precious Thimble believes there is power there. Something she might be able to use to take the shareholders home. They have a destination. But it is not mine.
Do you seek your mistress? There are no jungles east of here unless they exist on the far coast.
Gruntle started.
Jungles? No. You think too literally, Mappo. I seek a place at her side to fight a battle. If I am not there, she will indeed die. So my ghosts tell me in their haunting. It is not enough to arrive too late, to see the wound in her eyes, to know that all that you can hope to do is avenge what was done to her. Not enough, Trell. Never enough.
The wound in her eyes. You do this all for love? Mortal sword, do your ribs ache? Does she haunt you, whoever she was? Or is Trake simply feeding you the ripest meat? It is not enough to arrive too late. Oh, I know the truth of that. Violated. Raped. Now comes the dark question. Who profits from this?
Faint huddled under her furs, feeling as if she'd been dragged behind a carriage for a league or two. There was nothing worse than cracked ribs. Well, if she'd sat up only to find her severed head resting on her lap, that would be worse.
But probably painless, all things considered. Not like this. Miserable ache, 1,000 twinges vying for attention, until everything turns white and then red and then purple and finally blissful black. Where's the black? I'm waiting. Been waiting all night.
At dusk, Setok had drawn close to tell her that the Trell would be leaving on the morrow. How she knew was anyone's guess, since Mappo wasn't in any mood to talk, except to Gruntle, who was one of those men it was too easy to talk to, a man who just invited confession, as if giving off a scent or something. Hood knew she wanted to... A spasm. She stifled a gasp, waited out the throbs, and then sought to shift position once more. Not that one was more comfortable than any other. More a matter of duration. 20 breaths lying this way, 15 that way, and flat on her back was impossible. She'd never imagined how the weight of her own tits could crush the breath from her, and the gentle sweep of the furs threatened to close like a vice when she thought of settling her arms. It was all impossible, and come the dawn, she'd be ready to snap off heads.
Then Gruntel will leave us too. Not yet. But he won't stay. He can't.
Setok had a way with words, the heaps of good news she stacked like the coins of a private treasure. Maybe the grasses whispered in her ears as she lay there so gentle and damnably asleep, or the crickets and just listened to them. No, that was her spine crackling away. She fought back a moan. So before long it would be the shareholders and the barbarian Torrent, along with the three runts and Setok herself. She didn't count Cartographer, the wolf or the horses. Not for any particular reason, even if only the horses were actually alive.
I don't count them, that's all.
So just them, and who among them was tough enough to fight off the next attack from that winged lizard? Torrent? He looked too young, with the eyes of a hunted hare.
And only one bowl left, and that's bad. Poor boy's miserable. Here's the deal. Let's not bury any more friends, shall we?
But Precious Thimble was adamant. Raw power waited in the east. She thought she could do something with it. Open a warren, get the hood out of here.
Can't argue with that. Wouldn't want to. Sure, she's just a cherry of a lass, is our Precious. And if she's now regretting her teas, why, that will make her more careful from now on, which isn't a bad thing. A roll with Gruntel would be delicious, but it'd kill me. Besides, I'm all scarred up. Lopsided, huh? Who'd want a freak, except out of pity? Be rational and don't shy from its jagged edge. Your days of crooking a finger to get a tumble are done. Find some other hobby, woman. Spinning, maybe. Butter churning. Is that a hobby? Probably not. You can't sleep through this. Face it. It'll be months before a decent night, sleeping or otherwise.
Gruntel thinks he's going someplace to die. He doesn't want us to die with him.
That's nice, Setok. Thanks for that.
In the Crystal City there is a child. Beware the opening of his eyes.
Listen, sweetie, the little one right here needs his butt wiped, and the twins are pretending not to notice, but the smell's getting a tad rank, right? Take this handful of grass.
Life was so much better on the carriage, off delivering whatever. Faint grunted and then flinched at the pain.
Gods, woman, you're completely insane. Let me dream of a tavern. Smoky, crowded, a perfect table. We're all sitting there working out the shakes. Quell duck walks to the loo. The bowls make faces at each other and then laugh. Recanto's broken a thumb and he's putting it back in place. Glano can't see the barman. He can't even see the table in front of him. Sweetest Sufferance is looking like a plump cat with a rat's tail hanging from her mouth. Another pitcher arrives. Recanto looks up. Who's paying for this? He asks.
Faint cautiously lifted one hand, moved it up to brush her cheeks.
Blissful Black, you seem so far away.
In the false dawn, Torrent opened his eyes. Some violence still rocked in his skull, a dream, but already the memory of its details faded. Blinking, he sat up. Chill air stole in beneath his Rodara wool blanket, plucking at the beads of sweat on his chest. He glanced over at the horses, but the beasts stood calm, dozing. In the camp, the shapes of the others were motionless in the grainy half-light. Casting the blanket aside, he rose. The greenish glow was paling to the east. The warrior walked over to his horse, greeted it with a low murmur, and settled a hand upon its warm neck. Tales of cities and empires, of gas that burned with blue flame, of secret ways through the world that his eyes could not see, all left him disturbed, agitated, though he was not sure why. He knew Tok had come from such an empire, far away across the ocean, and his lone eye had looked upon scenes Torrent could not imagine. Yet around the All-Warrior now was a more familiar landscape, rougher than the Aldan, true, but just as open, sweeping, the earth levelled beneath the vast sky. What other sort of place could an honest man desire? The eyes could reach, the mind could stretch. There was space for everything, a tent or yurt for nightly shelter, a ring of stones to embrace the cookfire, the steam rising from the backs of the herds as the dawn gently broke. He longed for such a scene, the morning's greeting one he had always known. Dogs rising from their beds of grass, the soft cry of a hungry babe from one of the yurts, the smell of smoke as hearths were awakened once more. Sudden emotion gripped him, and he fought back a sob. All gone. Why am I still alive? Why do I cling to this misery, this empty life? When you are the last, there is no reason to keep living. All of your veins are cut. The blood drains and drains, and there's no end to it. Red Mask, you murdered us all. Did his kin await him in the spirit world? He wished he could believe. He wished his faith had never been shattered, crushed under the heel of leathery soldiers. If the All Spirits had been stronger, if they had been all the shamans said they were, we would not have died, not have failed. We would never have fallen. But if they existed at all, they were weak, ignorant, and helpless against change. Balanced on a bowstring, and when that string snapped, their world was done with, forever. He saw Setok awaken, watched her stand up, running fingers through the tangles in her hair. Wiping at his eyes, Torrent turned back to his horse, leaned his forehead against the slick coat of its neck. I feel you, friend. You do not question your life. You are in its midst and know no other place, nothing outside it. How I envy you. She approached him, the faint crunch of stones underfoot, the slow pulse of her breathing. She came up on his left, reaching to stroke the horse in the softness between its nostrils, giving it her scent.
Torrent, she whispered. Who is out there?
He grunted. Your wolf ghosts are torn, aren't they? Curious, frightened.
They smell death, and yet power. So much power.
The hide against his brow was now damp. She calls herself a bonecaster, a shaman, a witch. Her name is Olar Ethiel, and no life burns in her body.
She comes before the dawn, 3 mornings in a row now, but draws no closer. She hides like a hare, and when the sun's light finally arrives, she vanishes like dust.
Like dust, he agreed.
What does she want?
He stepped back from his horse, ran the back of one wrist against his brow, and looked away. Nothing good, Setok. She said nothing for a time, standing at his side, her furs wrapped tight about her shoulders. Then she seemed to shiver and said,
A snake writhes in each of her hands, but they're laughing.
Teller asked, Curdle, they dance in my dreams. They're dead, too. They're all dead, Setok, but still they hunger for something. He shrugged. We are all lost out here. I feel this like a rot in my bones.
I told Gruntle of my visions, the wolves and the throne they guard. Do you know what he asked me?
Torrent shook his head.
He asked me if I've seen the wolves lift a leg against that throne.
He snorted a laugh, but the sound shook him in an unexpected way. When did I last laugh? Spirits below.
It's how they mark territory,
Setok went on, her tone wry.
How they take possession of something. I was shocked, but not for long. They're beasts, after all. So what is it we worship when we worship them?
I worship no one anymore, Setok.
Gruntle says worship is nothing more than the surrender to things beyond our control. He says the comfort from that is false, because there is nothing comfortable in the struggle to live. He kneels to no one, not even his tiger of summer, who would dare compel him. She hesitated and then sighed and added, I will miss Gruntle.
He intends to leave us?
1,000 people can dream of war, but no 2 dreams are the same. Soon he will be gone, and Mappo too. The boy will be upset.
The 2 horses shied suddenly, stumbling in their hobbles. Stepping past them, Torrance scowled.
This dawn, he said in a growl. The hare is bold.
Precious Thimble bit back a shriek, clawed herself awake with a gasp. Traces of fire raced along her nerves. Kicking her bedding aside, she scrambled to her feet. Torrent and Setok stood near the horses, facing north. Someone was coming. The ground underfoot seemed to recoil in waves sweeping past her, like ripples passing just beneath the surface. Precious struggled to slow her gasping breaths. She set out to join the warrior and the girl, leaning forward as if fighting an invisible current. Hearing heavy footfalls behind her, she glanced back to see Gruntle and Mappo.
Be careful, Precious, Gruntle said. Against this one.
He shook his head. The barbed tattoos covering his skin were visibly deepening, and in his eyes there was nothing human. He'd yet to draw his cutlasses. Her gaze flicked to the trail, but his expression revealed nothing.
I didn't kill Jula. It wasn't my fault.
She spun back, pushed on. The figure striding towards them was withered, a crone swathed in snakeskins. As she drew closer, Precious could see the ravaged state of her broad face, the emptiness of her eye sockets. Behind her, Gruntle unleashed a feline hiss.
Tlani Mas. No weapons, meaning she's a bone caster. Precious Thimble, do not bargain with this one. She will offer you power to get what she wants. Refuse her.
Through gritted teeth, she replied,
We need to get home.
Not that way.
She shook her head. The crone halted 10 paces away, and to Precious Thimble's surprise, it was Torrent who spoke first.
Leave them alone, O Larathiel.
The hag cocked her head, wisps of hair drifting out like strands of spider silk.
There is only one, warrior. It is no concern of yours. I am here to claim my kin.
Your what? Which there's...
You cannot have him,
Gruntle rumbled, edging past Torrent.
Stay out of this, whelp,
Olarathiel warned.
Look to your god, and see how he cowers before me.
She then pointed a gnarled finger at Mappo.
And you, Trell, this is not your battle. Stand aside, and I will tell you all you need know of the one you seek.
Mappo seemed to stagger, and then, his face twisting in anguish, he stepped back. Precious gasped. Setok spoke.
Who is this kin of yours, witch?
He is named Absi.
Absi? There is no...
The boy!
Snapped Olarathiel.
The son of Onos Tulan! Bring him to me!
Gruntle drew his swords.
Don't be a fool!
The bonecaster snarled.
Your own god will stop you! Treach will not simply let you throw away your life on this... You think to veer? You will fail. I will kill you, mortal sword. Do not doubt that. The boy, bring him to me.
The rest were awake now, and Precious turned round to see Absi standing between the twins, his eyes wide and bright. Balljag was slowly coming forward, closer to where Setok stood, its massive head lowered. Ambi Bol remained close to his brother's barrow, closed in and silent, his once young face now old, and whatever love there had been in his eyes had vanished. Cartographer stood with one foot in the coals of the hearth, staring at something to the east, perhaps the rising sun, while Sweetest Sufferance was helping faint to her feet.
I need to try some more healing on her.
I can show Emby I don't always fail. I can... No, think about what is before us now. She gave Mappo what he wants, as easy as that. She bargains quick. She speaks true.
Precious faced the bonecaster.
Ancient one, we in the Trigal are stranded here. I have not the power to take us home. You will not interfere if I bless you with what you need?
Olar Athiel nodded.
Agreed. Collect the child.
Don't even think it,
Gruntle warned, the look in his unhuman eyes halting Precious in her tracks. The barbs on his bared arms seemed to blur a moment, then grew sharp once again. The bonecaster said,
The boy is mine, whelp, because his father belongs to me. The first sword serves me once again. Would you truly desire to prevent me from reuniting the son with the father?
Stavian's story rushed closer, their questions tumbling together.
Father, he's alive? Where is he?
Gruntle barred their way with a levelled cutlass.
Hold a moment, you two. Something is not right here. Wait, I beg you. Guard your brother.
He turned back to Olar Athiel.
If the boy's father now serves you, where is he?
Not far.
Then bring him to us, Gruntle said. He can collect his children himself.
The daughters are not of his blood,
Olar Athiel replied.
I have no use for them.
You? What of Onos Tulan?
Give them to me, then, and I will see to their disposal.
Torrent spun round. Slitting their throats is what she means, Gruntle.
I did not say that, warrior,
the bonecaster retorted.
I will take the three. This I offer.
Balljag was edging closer to Olar Athiel, and she beckoned to it.
Blessed eye, I greet you and invite you into my comp...
The huge beast lunged, massive jaws crunching as they closed round the bonecaster's right shoulder. The eye then spun, whipping Olar Athiel from her feet. Strips of reptile hide, fetishes of bone and shell flailed and snapped. The giant wolf did not release its grip, instead reared a second time, slamming Olar Athiel hard onto the ground. Bones splintered in its jaws, and the body struggled feebly, as would a victim stunned. Balljag tore loose its grip on her crushed shoulder and closed its fangs about her skull. It then whipped her into the air. Olar Athiel's left hand was suddenly stabbing into the eye's throat, punching through withered hide and closing on its spinal column. Even as the wolf flung her upward, she caught hold. The momentum from Balljag's surge added force to her grip. A sudden, terrible ripping sound erupted from the eye, and like a serpent, a length of the beast's spinal column tore free of its throat, still clutched in the witch's bony hand. The bonecaster spun away from the eye, landing hard in a clatter of bones. Balljag collapsed, head lolling like a stone in a sack. Absey wailed. As Olar Athiel was picking herself up, Gruntle marched towards her, his two weapons readied. Seeing him, she flung the spinal column to one side and began to veer. When he reached her, she was nothing but a blur, moments from expanding into something huge. He punched where her head had been a moment earlier, and the bell hilt of the cutlass cracked hard against something. The veering abruptly vanished. Reeling back, her face crushed, Olar Athiel sprawled on her back.
Spit on the tiger god, Gruntle said, standing directly over her. Who'd take your stupid veering and mine?
Clashing his blades together, he brought them down in an X pattern beneath her jaw.
Now, bonecaster, I happen to know that if you hit even Tlanimas bones hard enough, they shatter.
No, mortal!
Piss on that! I will leave you in pieces, do you understand me? Pieces! How's it done again? Head in a niche? On a pole? The crook of a tree?
No trees here, witch, but a hole in the ground, that's easy.
The child is mine.
He won't have you.
Why not?
You just killed his dog.
Precious Thimble hurried forward, feeling half-fevered, her knees wobbly beneath her.
Bonecaster, I am considering withdrawing my offers,
Olar Ethel said.
All of them. Now, mortal sword, will you remove your weapons and let me rise?
I haven't decided.
What must I promise? To leave Absi in your care? Will you guard his life, mortal sword?
Precious saw Gruntle hesitate.
I came to bargain with you all,
Olar Ethel continued.
In faith, the undead I was a slave to ancient memories, ancient betrayals. I will not hold it against any of you. Mortal sword, look upon your friends. Who among them is capable of protecting the children? You will not. The Trell waits only to hear my words whispering through his mind, and then he will quit your company. The All-Warrior is a pup, and a disrespectful one at that. The Jag Boliad's spawn is broken inside. I mean to bring to Onos Tulan his children.
He's a Tlani Mas, isn't he?
The Bonecaster was silent.
It's the only way he would still serve you, Gruntle said. He died just as his daughters believed, and you resurrected him. Will you do the same to the boy? The gift of your deathly touch?
Of course not. He must live.
Why?
She hesitated and then said,
Because he is the hope of my people, mortal sword. I need him for my army and for the first sword who commands them. The child Absi shall be their cause, their reason to fight.
Gruntle, precious saw, was suddenly pale.
A child? Their cause?
Their banner, yes. You do not understand. I cannot hold on to his anger. The first swords. It is dark, a beast unchained, a leviathan. He must not be unleashed, not this way. Burns, dream, mortal sword, let me rise!
Gruntle withdrew his weapons, stumbled back a step. He was muttering something under his breath. Precious Thimble caught only a few words in the Daru tongue.
The banner, child's tunic, was that it? The color began red, ended black.
Olar Ethel struggled to her feet. Her face was barely recognizable. A crushed, splintered knot of bone and torn hide. The gouges from Baljag's canines had scored deep white grooves on her temples and the base of her mandible on both sides. The ruined shoulder slumped, its arm hanging useless. As Gruntle backed still further, an anguished cry came from Setok.
Has she won you all, then? Will no one protect him? Please, please!
The twins were weeping. Absi was kneeling beside Baljag's desiccated body, moaning in a strange cadence. Cartographer clattered closer to the boy, one foot blackened and smouldering.
Make him stop that, someone. Make him stop that.
Precious frowned, but the others ignored the undead man's pleas.
What does he mean by that?
She turned to Olar Ethel.
Bonecaster. East, woman, that is where you will find all you need. I have touched your soul. I have made it into a mahib, a vessel that waits. East.
Precious Thimble crossed her arms, eyes closing for a moment. She wanted to look at Faint and Sweetest, to see the satisfaction, the relief in their eyes. She wanted to, but knew she would see nothing of the sort, not from those two. They were women, after all, and three children were being surrendered, thrown into undead arms.
They will thank me in the end, when the memory of this moment fades, when we are all safe and home again. Well, not all of us, but what can we do?
Setok, with Torrent at her side, was all that stood between Olar Ethel and the three children. Tears streamed down Setok's cheeks, and in the all-warrior's stance, Precious Thimble saw a man facing his execution. He'd drawn his saber, but the look in his eyes was bleak. Yet he did not waver. Among them all, this young warrior was the only one not to turn away.
"Damn you, Setok! Will you see this brave boy die?" "We can't stop her," Precious said to Setok. "You must see that. Torrent, tell her."
"I gave up the last of the all children to the Barghast," said Torrent, "and now they are all dead. Gone."
He shook his head.
"Can you protect these ones any better?"
Precious demanded. It was as if he'd been slapped. He looked away.
"Giving up children is the one thing I seem to do well."
He sheathed his weapon and grasped Setok's upper arm.
"Come with me. We will talk when no one else can hear us."
Setok shot the warrior a wild look, started to struggle, and then abruptly sagged in his grip. Precious watched him drag her away.
"He broke like a frail twig. Are you proud of yourself now, Precious? But the path is finally clear."
Olar Athil walked with a hitching gait she'd not shown before, joints grinding and snapping up to where the boy knelt. She reached down with her good arm and scooped him up by the collar of his Barghast tunic, held him out to study his face, and he in turn looked steadily back at her, dry-eyed, flat. The bonecaster grunted.
"Your father's son, all right, by the abyss."
She turned round and set off, northward, the boy hanging from her grip. After a moment, the twins followed, neither one looking back.
"There's no end to losing everything, is there? It just goes on and on. Their mother, their father, their people. No, they won't be looking back. And why should they? We've failed them. She came, she cut us apart, bought us like an empress scattering a handful of coins. And they were what she bought, them and our turning away. And it was easy, because this is what we are. Mahaib? What in Hood's name is that?"
With horror in his heart, Mappo set out from the camp, leaving the others, leaving behind this terrible dawn. He struggled to keep from breaking into a run, as if that would help. Besides, if they all watched him, they did so with consciences as stained as his own. Was there comfort in that? Should there be?
"We are nothing but our own needs. She but showed each of us the face we hide from ourselves and everyone else. She shamed us by exposing our truths."
He fought to remind himself of his purpose, of all that his vow demanded, and the horrifying things it could make him do.
"Ikarium lives. Remember that. Focus on it. He waits for me. I will find him. I will make it all right once again. Our small world, closed up and impervious to everything outside it. A world where none will challenge us, where none will question our deeds, the hateful decisions we once made. Give me this world, please, I beg you. My most precious lies. She stole them all. They saw. Setok, dear gods, the betrayal in your face. No, I will find him. I will protect him from the world. I will protect the world from him. And from everything else. From hurt eyes and broken hearts. I will protect myself. And you all called it my sacrifice. My heartbreaking loyalty. There on the path of hands, I took your breaths away. Bonecaster, you stole my lies. See me now."
He knew his ancestors were far, far away. Their bones crumbled to dust in chambers beneath heaped mounds of stone and earth. He knew he had forsaken them long ago. Then why could he hear their howls? Mappo clapped his hands over his ears, but that did not help. The howling went on and on. And on this vast, empty plain, he suddenly felt small, shrinking still further with each step.
"My heart, my honor, shrinking, withering down with each step. He's only a child. They all are.
He curled up in Gruntal's arms. The girls, they held on to Setok's hands and sang songs. Is it not the one inescapable responsibility of an adult to protect and defend a child? I am not as I once was. What have I done? Memories, the past, all so precious. I want it back. I want it all back. Icarium, I will find you. Icarium, please, save me.
Torrent climbed into his saddle. He looked down and met Setok's eyes and then nodded. He could see the fear and the doubt in her face and wished he had more words worth saying, but he'd used them all up. Was it not enough that he was doing this? The question, asked so boldly and self-righteously in his own mind, almost made him laugh out loud. Still, he had to do this. He had to try. I will ward them, I promise.
You owe them nothing, she said,
hugging herself with such severity he thought her ribs might crack.
Not your charge, but mine. Why do you do this?
I knew Tok.
Yes.
I think, what would he do? That is my answer, Setok. Tears ran down her face. She held her lips tight, as if to speak would be to loose her grief, a wailing demon that would never again be chained or beaten down. I left children to die once, he continued. I let Tok down. But this time, he shrugged, I hope to do better. Besides, she knows me. She will use me. She's done it before. He glanced over at the others. The camp was packed up. Faint and sweetest sufferance had already begun walking, like two broken refugees. Precious Thimble trailed them by a few steps, like a child uncertain of her welcome in their company. Ambi walked on his own, off to the right of the others, staring straight ahead, his stride stiff, brittle. And Gruntal, after a few words with Cartographer, who once more sat on Jeweler's barrow, had set off, shoulders rounded as if in visceral pain. Cartographer, it seemed, was staying behind. It comes together only to fall apart. Setok, your wolf ghosts were frightened of her.
Terrified.
You could do nothing? Her eyes flashed.
Is that supposed to help? Words like that just dig big holes and invite us to jump.
He glanced away. I'm sorry.
Go, catch up to them.
He collected his reins, swung his mount round and tapped its flanks with his heels. Did you gamble on this too, Olar Ethel? How smug will you sound in your greeting? Well now, enjoy your time, because it won't last forever. Not if I have any say in the matter. Do not worry, Tok. I've not forgotten. For you, I will do this, or die in the effort. He rode at a canter across the empty land, until he drew within sight of the Bonecaster and her three charges. When the twins turned and cried out in relief, it very nearly broke him. Setok had watched the young all-warrior ride after Olar Ethel, saw when he reached them. An exchange of words, and then they set out once more, walking until the deceptive folds of the landscape swallowed them all. Then she turned, studied Cartographer.
The boy was crying in grief over his dead dog. You told him to stop. Why? Why should that have so bothered you?
How is it?
The undead man said, rising from the barrow and shuffling closer.
That the weakest among us is the only one so willing to give up his life protecting those children. I do not mean to wound you with my words, Setok. I but struggle to understand this.
The withered face tilted to one side. Pitted eye sockets seeming to study her.
Is it perhaps because he has the least to lose?
He continued on in his awkward steps to stand over the carcass of the eye.
Of course he has, she snapped. As you said, just his life.
Cartographer looked down at the corpse of Baljag.
And this one had even less.
Go back to your dead world, will you? It's so much simpler there, I'm sure.
You can stop wondering about the things us pathetic mortals get up to.
I am a knower of maps, Setok. Listen to my words. You cannot cross the glass desert. When you reach it, turn southward onto the South Elan. It is not much better, but there should be enough, at least to give you a chance.
Enough what? Food? Water? Hope? You are remaining here. Why?
In this place, cartographer gestured, the world of the dead has arrived. Here, you are the unwelcome stranger.
Suddenly shaken, inexplicably distraught, Setok shook her head.
Gruntel said you were with them almost from the very beginning. Now you're just stopping. Here? Must we all have a purpose? Cartographer asked. I did once, but that is done with.
His head turned, faced northward.
Your company was admirable, but I'd forgotten.
He hesitated, and she was about to ask what he'd forgotten when he said,
Things break. Yes, she whispered,
not loud enough for him to hear. She reached down and collected the bundle of her gear. Straightening, she set out, then paused and glanced back at him.
Cartographer, what did Gruntel say to you at the barrow? The past is a demon that not even death can shake.
What did he mean by that?
He shrugged, still studying Balljag's carcass.
I told him this. I have found the living in my dreams, and they are not well.
She turned away, began walking. Dust devils spun and raced along, tracking her on either side. Marsan Gilani knew all about this. She'd heard all the old stories of the Seven Cities campaign, how the Logros Tlanimas had a way of just vanishing, whispering on the winds or twisting along on the currents of some river. Easy for them, rising from the ground at the end of it all, not even out of breath. She snorted. Breath, that was a good one. Her horse was reluctant this morning. Not enough water, not enough forage, hadn't crapped or pissed in a day and a night. Wouldn't last much longer, she suspected, unless her companions could conjure up a spring and a heap of hay or a bag or two of oats. Could they do things like that? She had no idea.
Be serious, woman. They looked as if a sleeping dragon had rolled over them.
If they could magic stuff out of nowhere, well, they'd have done something by now. She was hungry and thirsty too, and if it came to it, she'd slit her horse's neck and feast until her belly exploded.
Put that back together, will you?
Thanks. Not far now. By her reckoning, she'd be on the Bone Hunter's trail before noon, and by dusk she'd have caught up with them. No army that size could move very quickly. They were carrying enough supplies to feed a decent-sized town for half a year. She glanced northward, something she found she was doing rather often of late. No surprise in that impulse, however. It wasn't every day that a mountain grew up out of nowhere in the course of a single day and night, and what a storm accompanied its birth. She thought to hitch to one side for a spit or two, to punctuate the sardonic wonder she'd just chewed on. But spit was worth keeping.
Hold back one throat full, her mother used to say, for Hood's own face.
Bless her, the deranged fat cow. She must have given the ragged reaper a bubbly bath the day her time came, a hair wash, a cave mouth spring runoff of black stinking phlegm just gushing out, aye. Big women had a way, didn't they? Especially after their fourth or fifth decade, when all their opinions had turned to stone and chipped flinty enough to draw blood with a single glance or sneer. She'd moved like a tree, her mother had. And just as shocking to see, too. After all, trees don't walk much, not on a sober night, just like the earth didn't move unless Byrne was pitching or the man was better than he knew, and how rare was that? Loomed, old Ma did, like midnight thunder. death was a crowded chamber for women like her, and the crowd was the kind that parted with her first step into the room. A miracle. Masangilani wiped at her face, no sweat left. Bad news, especially this early in the morning. I wanted to be big, Ma. I wanted to reach that ripe old age. 50, aye. 5 bitching, rutting, terror-inspiring decades. I wanted to loom. Thunder in my eyes, thunder in my voice, a thing of great weights and inexorable masses. It ain't fair, me withering away out here. Dalhon, do you miss me? The day I set foot on that grassy sward, the day I shoo the first mob of flies from my lips and nostrils and eyes, why, that's the day all will be right with the world once again. No, don't leave me to die here, Dalhon. It ain't fair. She coughed, squinted ahead. Something of a mess up there, those two rises, the valley sprawled in between. Holes in the ground. Craters. The slopes seemed to be swarming. She blinked, wondering if she was imagining that. Deprivation played nasty games, after all. Swarming. It was swarming, all right. Rats? No. Orthon. A field of battle. She caught the gleam of picked bones, took note of ashy mounds on the far ridge, from pyres, no doubt. Sound practice burning the dead, she knew. Kept disease to a minimum. She kicked her horse into a heavy canter. I know, not for long, sweetie. The dust devils whirled out past her now, spinning towards a ridge overlooking the valley. Masangilani rode after them, to the top of the crest. There she reined in, scanning the wreckage filling the valley, and then the gaping entrenchments slashing across the opposite ridge, beyond which rose the humps of burned bones. Dread slowly seeped in, stealing all the day's heat from her bones. The Tlani mass of the unbound solidified in a rough line on her right, also studying the scene. Their sudden appearance after so many days of dust was strangely comforting to Masangilani. She'd only had her horse for company for far too long now. "Not that I'll kiss any of you," she said. Heads turned to regard her. None spoke. "Thank God for that." "My horse is dying," she announced. "And whatever happened here happened to my bone hunters, and it doesn't look good. So," she added, now glaring at the 5 undead warriors, "if you have any good news to tell me, or gods below any explanation at all, I really might kiss you." The one named Baroque said,
"We can answer your horse's plight, human."
"Good," she snapped, dismounting. "Get to it. And a little water and grub for yours truly wouldn't go amiss either. I won't be eating Orthon any more, just so you know. Whoever thought crossing a lizard with a rat was a good idea?" One of the other Tlani Mas stepped out from the line. She couldn't recall this one's name, but it was bigger than the others and looked to be composed of body parts from 3, maybe 4 individuals.
"Kachain Naruk," it said in a low voice. "A battle and a harvest."
"Harvest?" The creature pointed at the distant mounds.
"They butchered. They fed upon their fallen enemy."
Masangilani shivered. "Cannibals?"
"The Naruk are not human."
"That makes a difference. To me, it's cannibalism. Only white-skinned barbarians from the Fen Mountains sink so low as to eat other people, or so I hear."
"They did not complete their feeding," said the oversized Tlani Mas.
"What do you mean?"
"See the newborn mountain to the north?"
"No," she drawled. "Never noticed it." They all studied her again. Sighing, Masan said, "Aye, the mountain, the storm."
"Another battle," said Baroque. "An Azath was born. From this, we conclude that the Naruk were defeated."
"Oh, we hit them a second time? Good."
"Kachain Chemal," said Baroque. "Civil war, Masangilani."
The warrior gestured with a twisted arm.
Your army, I do not think they all died. Your commander...
Tavare's alive, then?
Her sword is.
Her sword? Oh, that Utataral blade. Can I send you ahead? Can you find a trail if there is one?
Senik will scout the pass before us,
Baruch said.
It is a risk. Strangers would not welcome us.
I can't imagine why. Another protracted look. Then Baruch said,
If our enemies should find us, Masan Gelani, before the moment of our final resurrection, then all we aspire to win will be lost.
Win? Win what?
Why, our master's release.
She thought about asking a few more questions, decided against it. Gods below, you're not who I was sent to find, are you? Still, you wanted to find us, didn't you? Sinter, I wish you were here to explain what's going on. But my gut's telling me bad things. Your master? No, don't tell me. All right, let's ride clear of this, and then you feed us like you promised. But decent food, right? I'm civilized, Dalhonese, Malazan Empire. The Emperor himself came from Dalhon.
Masan Gelani, said Baruch, we know nothing of this empire of which you speak.
The Talanimas warrior paused and then added,
But the one who was once emperor, him we do know.
Really? Before or after he died? The five Imas regarded her once more. Then Baruch asked,
Masan Gelani, what is the relevance of that question?
She blinked and then slowly shook her head. None. None at all, I guess. Another Tlanimas spoke now.
Masan Gelani?
What?
Your old emperor.
What of him?
Was he a liar?
Masan Gelani scratched her head, and then she gathered up her reins, swung back onto her horse. That depends.
On what?
On whether you believe all the lies people say about him. Now let's get out of this, eat and get watered, and then find Tavare's sword. And if Opon's smiling down on us, she'll still be attached to it. She was startled when the five Imas bowed. Then they collapsed into dust and swirled away. Where's the dignity in that? She wondered, and then looked out one more time over the battlefield and its seething Orthon. Where's the dignity in anything, woman? For now, keep it all inside. You don't know what has happened here. You don't know anything for certain. Not yet. Just hold on. There's plenty of dignity in just holding on, the way Ma did. The smell of burning grass, wetness pressed against one cheek, cold air upon the other, the close sound of a click beetle, sunlight filtered through shut lids, dusty air seeping into his lungs and then back out again. There were parts of him lying about, in pieces, or so it felt, but even the idea of it seemed impossible, so he discarded the notion despite what his senses were telling him. Thoughts, nice to find he was having them, a notable triumph. Now, if he could just pull his varied bits together, the ones that weren't there, but that could wait. First, he needed to find some memories. His grandmother, well, an old woman at least. Assumptions could be dangerous. One of her sayings, maybe. What about parents? What about them? Try to remember. How hard can that be? His parents. Not very bright, those two. Strange in their dullness. He'd always wondered if there wasn't more to them. There had to be, didn't there? Hidden interests, secret curiosities. Was Mother really that fascinated by what Widow Thirdly was wearing today? Was that the extent of her engagement with the world? The poor neighbor only owned two tunics and one ankle-length robe, after all, and pretty threadbare at that, as befitted a woman whose husband was a withered corpse in the sands of Seven Cities, and the death coin wasn't much to live by, was it? and that old man from down the street, the one trying to court her. Well, he was just out of practice, that's all. Not worth your sneers, Mother. He's just doing his best, dreaming of a happier life, dreaming of waking something up in the widow's sad eyes. It's an empty world without hope. And if Father had a way of puttering about, whistling some endless song and pausing every now and then to look distracted by a thought, if not thoroughly confused by its very existence, well, a man of decent years had plenty to think about, didn't he? It certainly looked like that. And if he had a way of ducking in crowds, of meeting no one's eyes, well, there was a world of men who'd forgotten how to be men. Or maybe they never learned in the first place. Were these his parents, or someone else's? Revelations landing with a thud. 1, 3, scores of them, a veritable landslide. How old had he been? 15? The streets of Jakarta suddenly narrowing before his eyes, the houses shrinking, the big men of the block dwindling to boastful midgets with puny eyes. There was a whole other world out there, somewhere. Grandma caught a glint in your eyes. You'd beaten the dust out of the gold carpet, rolled it out into my path. For these tender feet of mine, a whole other world out there, called learning, called knowledge, called magic. Roots and grubs and tied-off twists of someone's hair, small puppets and dolls with smeared faces of thread, webs of gut, bundles of shedding, the plucked backs of crows, etching on the clay floor, the drip-drip of sweat from the brow. Mud was effort, the taste on the tongue that of grit from a licked stylus, and how the candles flickered and the shadows leapt. Grandma, your gem of a boy tore himself apart. He had fangs in his flesh, and those fangs were his own, and round it went, biting, tearing, hissing in agony and fury, plummeting from the smoke-filled sky. Lifting upward again, new wings, joints creaking, a sliding nightmare. You can't come back from that. You can't. I touched my own dull flesh, and it was buried under bodies, all that gore draining down. I was pickled in blood. That body, I mean. What used to be mine. You don't go back, not to that. Dead limbs shifting, slack faces turning, pretending to look at me. But I wasn't the one so rude as to drag them about. No need to accuse me with those blank eyes. Some fool's coming down here, and maybe my soaked skin feels warm, but that's all the lost heat from all these other corpses. I don't come back, not from that. Father, if you only knew the things I have seen. Mother, if only you'd opened your own heart. Enough to bless that broken widow next door. Explain it to this fool, will you? It was a mound of bodies. They'd gathered us. Friend, you weren't supposed to interfere. Maybe they ignored you, though I can't figure why. And your touch was cold. Gods, it was cold. Rats, nuzzling close, they'd snatched fragments of me out of the air. In a world where everyone is a soldier, the ones underfoot don't get noticed. But even ants fight like fiends. My rats, they worked hard, warm bodies like nests. They couldn't get all of me. That wasn't possible. Maybe you pulled me out, but I was incomplete. Or not. Grandma, someone tied strings to me. With everything coming down all around us, he'd knotted strings to my hood-damned rats. Oh, clever bastard, quick. Clever, clever bastard. All there, all here, I'm all here. And then someone dug me out, carried me away, and the short tails looked over every now and then, milled as if contemplating taking objection, but never did. He carried me away, melting as he went. All the butchering going on. They had a way of puttering about, whistling some endless song and pausing every now and then to look distracted by a thought. If not thoroughly confused by its very existence, like that. So he carried me away, and where was everybody? The pieces were back together, and Bottle opened his eyes. He was lying on the ground, the sun low to the horizon, dew in the yellow grasses close to his face, smelling of the night just past. Morning. He sighed, slowly sat up, his body feeling crazed with cracks. He looked across at the man crouched near a dung fire. His touch was cold, and then he melted. "Captain Ruthen Gud, sir." The man glanced over, nodded, resumed combing his beard with his fingers.
"It's a bird, I think."
"Sir?" He gestured at the rounded lump of scorched meat skewered above the embers.
"Just sort of fell out of the sky. Had feathers, but they've burned off."
He shook his head.
"Had teeth, too, however. Bird, lizard, it's an even handful of straws in each hand, as the strike used to say."
"We're alone."
"For now. We've not been gaining on them much. You start getting heavy after a while."
"Sir, you have been carrying me?" Melting, drip, drip. "How far? How many days?"
"Carrying you? What am I, a Toblakai? No, there's a travoy behind you. Dragging's easier than carrying, somewhat. Wish I had a dog. When I was a child, well, let's just say that wishing I had a dog has been an unfamiliar experience. But yesterday I'd have cut a god's throat for one single dog."
"I can walk now, sir."
"But can you pull that travoy?"
Frowning, Bottle twisted and looked at the conveyance. Two full-length spear shafts, the pieces of two or three others, webbing from the harnesses of leather armor, the strips stained black.
"Nothing to pull in it, sir, that I can see."
"I was thinking me, Marine."
"Well, I can..."
Ruthen picked up the spit and waved it about.
"A joke, soldier. Ha ha. Here, this thing looks ready. Cooking is the process of making the familiar unrecognizable and thus palatable. When intelligence was first born, the first question asked was, can this thing be cooked? After all, try eating a cow's face. Well, true enough, people do. Oh, never mind. You must be hungry."
Bottle made his way over. Ruthen plucked the bird from the skewer and then tore it in half, handing one section to the marine. They ate without conversation. At last, sucking and spitting out the last bone, licking grease from his fingers, Bottle sighed and eyed the man opposite him.
"I saw you go down, sir, under about 100 short tails."
Ruthen raked his beard.
"Aye."
Bottle glanced away, tried again.
"Figured you were dead."
"Couldn't get through the armor, but I'm still a mass of bruises. Anyway, they pounded me into the ground for a while and then just, well, gave up."
He grimaced.
"Took me some time to dig free. By then, apart from the dead they were collecting, there was no sign of the bone hunters or our allies. The Kundril looked finished, never saw so many dead horses, and the trenches had been overrun. The Lethary had delivered and taken some damage, but hard to guess the extent of either."
"I think I saw some of that," Bottle said.
"I sniffed you out, though,"
the captain said, not meeting Bottle's eyes.
"How?"
"I just did. You were barely there, but enough. So I pulled you free."
"And they just watched."
"Did they? Never noticed that."
He wiped his hands on his thighs and rose.
"Ready to walk then, soldier?"
"I think so. Where are we going, sir?"
"To find the ones still left."
"When was the battle?"
4 or 5 days ago, something like that."
"Sir, are you a storm rider?"
"A rogue wave?"
Bottle's frown deepened.
"Another joke," said Ruthen Gud. "Let's strip what's on the travoy. Found you a sword, a few other things you might find useful."
"It was all a mistake, wasn't it?"
The man shot him a look.
"Everything is, soldier, sooner or later."
Chaos foamed in a thrashing maelstrom far below. He stood close to the ledge, looking down. Off to his right, the rock tilted, marking the end of the vaguely level base of the pinnacle, and at the far end, the spar, a gnarled thing of black, stabbing upward like a giant finger, seemed to cast a penumbra of white mist from its ragged tip. Eventually he turned away, crossed the flat stretch, 12 paces to a sheer wall of rock, and to the mouth of a tunnel where shattered boulders had spilled out to the sides. He clambered over the nearest heap until he found a dusty oilskin cape jammed inside a crevasse. Tugging it aside, he reached down and withdrew a tattered satchel. It was so rotted, the base began splitting at the seams, and he scrambled quickly to flat ground before the contents spilled out. Coins pattered, baubles struck and clattered. 2 larger items, both wrapped in skins and each the length of a man's forearm, struck the bedrock but made no sound. These objects were the only ones he collected, tucking one into his belt and unwrapping the other. A scepter of plain black wood, its ends capped in tarnished silver. He examined it for a moment and then strode to the base of the spire of Andi. Rummaging in the pouch at his hip, he withdrew a knotted clutch of horsehair, dropped it at his feet, and then with a broad sweeping motion used the scepter to inscribe a circle above the black stone. Then he stepped back. After a moment his breath caught and he half turned. When he spoke his tone was apologetic.
"Ah, mother, it's old blood, I don't deny it. Old and thin."
He hesitated and then said,
"Tell father I make no apologies for my choice. Why should I? No matter. The 2 of us did the best I could."
He grunted in humor.
"And you might say the same thing."
He turned back. Darkness was knotting into something solid before him. He watched it for a time, saying nothing, although her presence was palpable, vast in the gloom behind him.
"If he'd wanted blind obedience, he should have kept me chained. And you, mother, you should have kept me a child forever, there under your wing."
He sighed, somewhat shakily.
"We're still here, but then we did what you both wanted. We almost got them all. The one thing none of us expected was how it would change us."
He glanced back again, momentarily.
"And it has."
Within the circle before him, the dark form opened crimson eyes. Hoofs cracked like iron axe blades on the stone. He grasped the apparition's midnight mane and swung onto the beast's back.
"Where your child, mother?"
He drew the horse round, walked it along the ledge a few strides and then back to the mouth of the tunnel.
"I've been among them for so long now. What you gave me is the barest whisper in the back of my soul. You offered scant regard for humans, and now it's all coming down. But I give you this."
He swung the horse round.
"Now it's our turn. Your son opened the way, and as for his son, well, if he wants the scepter, he'll have to come and take it."
Ben Edifon Delat tightened his grip on the horse's mane.
"You do your part, mother. Let father do his, if he's of a mind to. But it comes down to us. So stand back, shield your eyes, because I swear to you, we will blaze. When our backs are against the wall, mother, you have no idea what we can do."
He drove his heels into the horse's flanks. The creature surged forward.
"Now, sweet haunt, this could get a little hairy."
The horse reached the ledge, then out into the air, and down, plunging into the seething maelstrom. The presence, breathing darkness, remained in the vast chamber for a time longer. The strewn scatter of coins and baubles glittered on the black stone. Then came a tapping of a cane upon rock.